Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Chapter 16 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Awakening. I awoke with a start. For a moment I wondered where I was. Then memory came to me. The room was still lit with that strange light, half sun, half moonlight. I felt refreshed, and the tired, weary ache had left me. I went slowly across to the window and looked out. Overhead, the river of flame drove up and down, north and south, in a dancing semicircle of fire. As a mighty sleigh in the loom of time, it seemed, in a sudden fancy of mine, to be beating home the picks of the years, for so vastly had the passage of time been accelerated that there was no longer any sense of the sun passing from east to west. The only apparent movement was the north and south beat of the sun-stream that had become so swift now as to be better described as a quiver. As I peered out, there came to me a sudden, inconsequent memory of that last journey among the outer worlds. I remembered the sudden vision that had come to me as I neared the solar system of the fast, whirling planets about the sun. As though the governing quality of time had been held in abeyance, and the machine of a universe allowed to run down an eternity in a few moments or hours. The memory passed along with a, but partially comprehended, suggestion that I had been permitted a glimpse into further time-spaces. I stared out again, seemingly at the quake of the sun-stream. The speed seemed to increase even as I looked. Several lifetimes came and went as I watched. Suddenly it struck me with a sort of grotesque seriousness that I was still alive. I thought of Pepper and wondered how it was that I had not followed his fate. He had reached the time of his dying and had passed, probably through sheer lengths of years. And here was I, alive. Hundreds of thousands of centuries after my rightful period of years. For a time I mused absently. Yesterday, I stopped suddenly. Yesterday? There was no yesterday. The yesterday of which I spoke had been swallowed up in the abyss of years, ages gone. I grew dazed with much thinking. Presently I turned from the window and glanced round the room. It seemed different, strangely and utterly different. Then I knew what it was that made it appear so strange. It was bare. There was not a piece of furniture in the room, not even a solitary fitting of any sort. Gradually my amazement went as I remembered that this was but the inevitable end of the process of decay, which I had witnessed commencing before my sleep. Thousands of years! Millions of years! Over the floor was spread a deep layer of dust that reached halfway up to the window-seat. It had grown immeasurably whilst I slept and represented the dust of untold ages. Undoubtedly, atoms of the old decayed furniture helped to swell its bulk, and somewhere among it all moldered the long-ago-dead Pepper. All at once, it occurred to me that I had no recollection of wading knee-deep through all that dust after I awoke. True, an incredible age of years had passed since I approached the window, but that was evidently as nothing compared with the countless spaces of time that I conceived had vanished whilst I was sleeping. I remembered now that I had fallen asleep sitting in my old chair. Had it gone? I glanced toward where it had stood. Of course, there was no chair to be seen. I could not satisfy myself whether it had disappeared after my waking or before. If it had moldered under me, surely I should have been waked by the collapse. Then I remembered that the thick dust which covered the floor would have been sufficient to soften my fall, so that it was quite possible I had slept upon the dust for a million years or more. As these thoughts wandered through my brain, I glanced again casually to where the chair had stood. Then, for the first time, I noticed that there were no marks in the dust of my footprints between it and the window. But then ages of years had passed since I had awakened. Tens of thousands of years! My look rested thoughtfully again upon the place where once had stood my chair. Suddenly, I passed from abstraction to intentness, for there, in its standing place, I made out a long undulation rounded off with the heavy dust. Yet it was not so much hidden but that I could tell what had caused it. I knew, and shivered at the knowledge, that it was a human body, ages dead, lying there beneath the place where I had slept. It was lying on its right side, its back turned toward me. I could make out and trace each curve and outline softened and molded, as it were, in the black dust. In a vague sort of way, I tried to account for its presence there. Slowly, I began to grow bewildered, as the thought came to me that it lay just about where I must have fallen when the chair collapsed. Gradually, an idea began to form itself within my brain, a thought that shook my spirit. It seemed hideous and insupportable, yet it grew upon me steadily until it became a conviction. The body under that coating, that shroud of dust, was neither more nor less than my own dead shell. I did not attempt to prove it. I knew it now, and wondered I had not known it all along. I was a bodiless thing. A while I stood, trying to adjust my thoughts to this new problem. In time, how many thousands of years I know not, I attained to some degree of quietude, sufficient to enable me to pay attention to what was transpiring around me. Now I saw that the elongated mound had sunk, collapsed, level with the rest of the spreading dust, and fresh atoms impalpable had settled above that mixture of grave powder which the eons had ground. A long while I stood, turned from the window. Gradually I grew more collected while the world slipped across the centuries into the future. Presently I began a survey of the room. Now I saw that time was beginning its destructive work even on this strange old building. That it had stood through all the years was, it seemed to me, proof that it was something different from any other house. I do not think, somehow, that I had thought of its decaying, though why I could not have said. It was not until I had meditated upon the matter for some considerable time that I fully realized that the extraordinary space of time through which it had stood was sufficient to have utterly pulverized the very stones of which it was built, had they been taken from any earthly quarry. Yes, it was undoubtedly mouldering now. All the plaster had gone from the walls, even as the woodwork of the room had gone many ages before. While I stood in contemplation, a piece of glass from one of the small diamond-shaped panes dropped with a dull tap amid the dust upon the sill behind me and crumbled into a little heap of powder. As I turned from contemplating it, I saw light between a couple of the stones that formed the outer wall. Evidently the mortar was falling away. After a while I turned once more to the window and peered out. I discovered now that the speed of time had become enormous. The lateral quiver of the sunstream had grown so swift as to cause the dancing semicircle of flame to merge into and disappear in a sheet of fire. that covered half the southern sky from east to west. From the sky I glanced down to the gardens. They were just a blur of a palish, dirty green. I had a feeling that they stood higher than in the old days, a feeling that they were nearer my window, as though they had risen bodily. Yet they were still a long way below me, for the rock, over the mouth of the pit on which this house stands, arches up to a great height. It was later that I noticed a change in the constant color of the gardens. The pale, dirty green was growing ever paler and paler toward white. At last, after a great space, they became grayish-white and stayed thus for a very long time. Finally, however, the grayness began to fade, even as had the green, into a dead white. And this remained constant and unchanged. And by this I knew that at last snow lay upon all the northern world. And so, by millions of years, time winged onward through eternity to the end. The end of which, in the old earth days, I had thought remotely and in hazily speculative fashion. And now it was approaching in a manner of which none had ever dreamed. I recollect that, about this time, I began to have a lively, though morbid, curiosity as to what would happen when the end came. But I seemed strangely without imaginings. All this while, the steady process of decay was continuing. The few remaining pieces of glass had long ago vanished, and every now and then a soft thud and a little cloud of rising dust would tell of some fragment of fallen mortar or stone. I looked up again to the fiery sheet that quaked in the heavens above me, and far down into the southern sky. As I looked, the impression was borne in upon me that it had lost some of its fiery brilliancy, that it was duller, deeper hued. I glanced down once more to the blurred white of the worldscape. Sometimes my look returned to the burning sheet of dulling flame that was and yet hid the sun. At times I glanced behind me into the growing dusk of the great, silent room with its eon carpet of sleeping dust. So I watched through the fleeting ages, lost in soul-wearing thoughts and wanderings, and possessed with a new weariness. End of chapter 16. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 17 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Slowing Rotation. It might have been a million years later that I perceived, beyond possibility of doubt, that the fiery sheet that lit the world was indeed darkening. Another vast space went by, and the whole enormous flame had sunk to a deep copper color. Gradually it darkened from copper to copper red, and from this, at times, to a deep, heavy, purplish tint, with, in it, a strange loom of blood. Although the light was decreasing, I could perceive no diminishment in the apparent speed of the sun. It still spread itself in that dazzling veil of speed. The world, so much of it as I could see, had assumed a dreadful shade of gloom, as though in the very deed the last day of the worlds approached. The sun was dying, of that there could be little doubt, and still the earth whirled onward through space and all the eons. At this time, I remember an extraordinary sense of bewilderment took me. I found myself later wandering mentally amid an odd chaos of fragmentary modern theories and the old biblical story of the world's ending. Then, for the first time, there flashed across me the memory that the sun, within its system of planets, was, and had been, traveling through space at an incredible speed. Abruptly the question rose, where? For a very great time I pondered this matter, but finally, with a certain sense of the futility of my puzzlings, I let my thoughts wander to other things. I grew to wondering how much longer the house would stand. Also I queried to myself,
whether I should be doomed to stay bodiless upon the earth through the dark time that I knew was coming. From these thoughts I fell again to speculations upon the possible direction of the sun's journey through space. And so another great while passed. Gradually, as time fled, I began to feel the chill of a great winter. Then I remembered that, with the sun dying, the cold must be necessarily extraordinarily intense. Slowly, slowly, as the eons slipped into eternity, the earth sank into a heavier and redder gloom. The dull flame in the firmament took on a deeper tint, very somber and turbid. Then at last it was borne upon me that there was a change. The fiery, gloomy curtain of flame that hung quaking overhead and down away into the southern sky began to thin and contract, and in it, as one sees the fast vibrations of a jarred harp-string, I saw once more the sun-stream quivering, giddily, north and south. Slowly the likeness to a sheet of fire disappeared, and I saw plainly the slowing beat of the sun-stream. Yet even then the speed of its swing was inconceivably swift, and all the time the brightness of the fiery arc grew ever duller. Underneath the world loomed dimly an indistinct ghostly region. Overhead the river of flame swayed slower and even slower, until at last it swung to the north and south in great ponderous beats that lasted through seconds. A long space went by, and now each sway of the great belt lasted nigh a minute, so that after a great while I ceased to distinguish it as a visible movement, and the streaming fire ran in a steady river of dull flame across the deadly-looking sky. An indefinite period passed, and it seemed that the arc of fire became less sharply defined. It appeared to me to grow more attenuated, and I thought blackish streaks showed occasionally. Presently, as I watched, the smooth onward flow ceased, and I was able to perceive that there came a momentary but regular darkening of the world. This grew until once more night descended in short but periodic intervals upon the wearying earth. Longer and longer became the nights, and the days equaled them, so that at last the day and the night grew to the duration of seconds in length, and the sun showed once more like an almost invisible, coppery red-colored ball, with the glowing mistiness of its flight. Corresponding to the dark lines showing at times in its trail, there were now distinctly to be seen on the half-visible sun itself great dark belts. Year after year flashed into the past, and the days and nights spread into minutes. The sun had ceased to have the appearance of a tail, and now rose and set, a tremendous globe of a glowing copper-bronze hue, in parts ringed with blood-red bands, in others with the dusky ones that I have already mentioned. These circles, both red and black, were of varying thickness. For a time I was at a loss to account for their presence. Then it occurred to me that it was scarcely likely that the sun would cool evenly all over, and that these markings were due probably to differences in temperature in the various areas, the red representing those parts where the heat was still fervent, and the black those portions which were already comparatively cool. It struck me as a peculiar thing that the sun should cool in evenly defined rings, until I remembered that possibly they were but isolated patches, to which the enormous rotatory speed of the sun had imparted a belt-like appearance. The sun itself was very much greater than the sun I had known in the old world days, and from this I argued that it was considerably nearer. At nights, the moon.
Author's footnote: no further mention is made of the moon. From what is said here, it is evident that our satellite had greatly increased its distance from the earth. Possibly at a later age it may even have broken loose from our attraction. I cannot but regret that no light is shed on this point. End author's footnote.
Still showed, but small and remote, and the light she reflected was so dull and weak that she seemed little more than the small dim ghost of the olden moon that I had known. Gradually the days and nights lengthened out until they equaled a space somewhat less than one of the old earth hours, the sun rising and setting like a great ruddy bronze disk crossed with ink-black bars. About this time I found myself able once more to see the gardens with clearness, for the world had now grown very still and changeless. Yet I am not correct in saying gardens, for there were no gardens, nothing that I knew or recognized. In place thereof I looked out upon a vast plain stretching away into the distance. A little to my left there was a low range of hills. Everywhere there was a uniform white covering of snow, in places rising into hummocks and ridges. It was only now that I recognized how really great had been the snowfall. In places it was vastly deep, as was witnessed by a great upleaping wave-shaped hill away to my right, though it is not impossible that this was due in part to some rise in the surface of the ground. Strangely enough, the range of low hills to my left, already mentioned, was not entirely covered with the universal snow. Instead, I could see their bare, dark sides showing in several places, and everywhere and always there reigned an incredible death silence and desolation, the immutable, awful quiet of a dying world. All this time, the days and nights were lengthening perceptibly. Already each day occupied maybe some 2 hours from dawn to dusk. At night I had been surprised to find that there were very few stars overhead, and these small, though of an extraordinary brightness, which I attributed to the peculiar but clear blackness of the night-time. Away to the north I could discern a nebulous sort of mistiness, not unlike in appearance a small portion of the Milky Way. It might have been an extremely remote star-cluster. Or, the thought came to me suddenly, perhaps it was the sidereal universe that I had known, and now left far behind, forever, a small, dimly glowing mist of stars, far in the depths of space. Still, the days and nights lengthened slowly. Each time the sun rose duller than it had set, and the dark belts increased in breadth. About this time there happened a fresh thing. The sun, earth, and sky were suddenly darkened, and, apparently, blotted out for a brief space. I had a sense, a certain awareness, I could learn little by sight, that the earth was enduring a very great fall of snow. Then, in an instant, the veil that had obscured everything vanished, and I looked out once more. A marvelous sight met my gaze. The hollow in which this house, with its garden, stands was brimmed with snow.
Author's footnote, conceivably frozen air. End author's footnote.
It lipped over the sill of my window. Everywhere it lay a great level stretch of white, which caught and reflected gloomily the somber coppery glows of the dying sun. The world had become a shadowless plain, from horizon to horizon. I glanced up at the sun. It shone with an extraordinary dull clearness. I saw it now, as one who until then had seen it, only through a partially obscuring medium. All about it the sky had become black, with a clear, deep blackness, frightful in its nearness and its unmeasured deep and its utter unfriendliness. For a great time I looked into it, newly and shaken and fearful. It was so near. Had I been a child, I might have expressed some of my sensation and distress by saying that the sky had lost its roof. Later I turned and peered about me into the room. Everywhere it was covered with a thin shroud of the all-pervading white. I could see it but dimly, by reason of the somber light that now lit the world. It appeared to cling to the ruined walls, and the thick, soft dust of the years that covered the floor knee-deep was nowhere visible. The snow must have blown in through the open framework of the windows, yet in no place had it drifted, but lay everywhere about the great old room smooth and level. Moreover, there had been no wind these many thousand years. but there was the snow.
Author's footnote. See previous footnote. This would explain the snow within the room. End author's footnote.
As I have told. And all the earth was silent, and there was a cold such as no living man can ever have known. The earth was now illuminated by day with a most doleful light, beyond my power to describe. It seemed as though I looked at the great plain through the medium of a bronze-tinted sea. It was evident that the earth's rotatory movement was departing steadily. The end came, all at once. The night had been the longest yet, and when the dying sun showed at last above the world's edge, I had grown so wearied of the dark that I greeted it as a friend. It rose steadily, until about 20 degrees above the horizon. Then it stopped suddenly, and after a strange retrograde movement, hung motionless, a great shield in the sky.
Author's footnote. I am confounded that neither here nor later on does the recluse make any further mention of the continued north and south movement, apparent, of course, of the sun from solstice to solstice. End of author's footnote.
Only the circular rim of the sun showed bright. Only this, and one thin streak of light near the equator. Gradually, even this thread of light died out. And now, all that was left of our great and glorious sun was a vast, dead disk, rimmed with a thin circle of bronze-red light.
End of chapter 17. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Chapter 18 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording was in the public domain. The Green Star. The world was held in a savage gloom, cold and intolerable. Outside all was quiet. Quiet! From the dark room behind me came the occasional soft thud.
Author's footnote. At this time the sound-carrying atmosphere must have been either incredibly attenuated, or more probably non-existent. In the light of this, it cannot be supposed that these or any other noises would have been apparent to living ears, to hearing as we in the material body understand that sense. End of author's footnote.
Of falling matter, fragments of rotting stone. So time passed, and night grasped the world, wrapping it in wrappings of impenetrable blackness. There was no night sky as we know it. Even the few straggling stars had vanished conclusively. I might have been in a shuttered room without a light for all that I could see. Only in the impalpableness of gloom opposite burnt that vast, encircling hair of dull fire. Beyond this there was no ray in all the vastitude of night that surrounded me, save that far in the north that soft, mist-like glow still shone. Silently, years moved on. What period of time passed I shall never know. It seemed to me waiting there that eternities came and went stealthily. And still I watched. I could see only the glow of the sun's edge at times, for now it had commenced to come and go, lighting up a while, and again becoming extinguished. All at once, during one of these periods of life, a sudden flame cut across the night, a quick glare that lit up the dead earth shortly, giving me a glimpse of its flat lonesomeness. The light appeared to come from the sun, shooting out from somewhere near its center diagonally. A moment I gazed, startled. Then the leaping flame sank and the gloom fell again. But now it was not so dark, and the sun was belted by a thin line of vivid white light. I stared intently. Had a volcano broken out on the sun? Yet I negatived the thought as soon as formed. I felt that the light had been far too intensely white and large for such a cause. Another idea there was that suggested itself to me,
It was that one of the inner planets had fallen into the sun, becoming incandescent under that impact. This theory appealed to me as being more plausible and accounting more satisfactorily for the extraordinary size and brilliance of the blaze that had lit up the dead world so unexpectedly. Full of interest and emotion, I stared across the darkness at that line of white fire cutting the night. One thing it told me unmistakably: the sun was yet rotating at an enormous speed.
Author's footnote. I can only suppose that the time of the earth's yearly journey had ceased to bear its present relative proportion to the period of the sun's rotation. End of author's footnote.
Thus I knew that the years were still fleeting at an incalculable rate, though, so far as the earth was concerned, life and light and time were things belonging to a period lost in the long-gone ages. After that one burst of flame, the light had shone only as an encircling band of bright fire. Now, however, as I watched, it began slowly to sink into a ruddy tint, and later to a dark copper-red color, much as the sun had done. Presently it sank to a deeper hue, and in a still further space of time it began to fluctuate, having periods of glowing and anon dying. Thus, after a great while, it disappeared. Long before this, the smoldering edge of the sun had deadened into blackness, and so in that supremely future time the world, dark and intensely silent, rode on its gloomy orbit around the ponderous mass of the dead sun. My thoughts at this period can be scarcely described. At first they were chaotic and wanting in coherence, but later, as the ages came and went, my soul seemed to imbibe the very essence of the oppressive solitude and dreariness that held the earth. With this feeling there came a wonderful clearness of thought, and I realized despairingly that the world might wander for ever through that enormous night. For a while the unwholesome idea filled me with a sensation of overbearing desolation, so that I could have cried like a child. In time, however, this feeling grew almost insensibly less, and an unreasoning hope possessed me. Patiently I waited. From time to time the noise of dropping particles behind in the room came dully to my ears. Once I heard a loud crash, and turned instinctively to look, forgetting for the moment the impenetrable night in which every detail was submerged. In a while my gaze sought the heavens, turning unconsciously toward the north. Yes, the nebulous glow still showed. Indeed, I could have almost imagined that it looked somewhat plainer. For a long time I kept my gaze fixed upon it, feeling in my lonely soul that its soft haze was in some way a tie with the past. Strange, the trifles from which one can suck comfort. And yet, had I but known— but I shall come to that in its proper time. For a very long space I watched, without experiencing any of the desire for sleep that would so soon have visited me in the old earth days. How I should have welcomed it, if only to have passed the time away from my perplexities and thoughts. Several times the comfortless sound of some great piece of masonry falling disturbed my meditations, and once it seemed I could hear whispering in the room behind me. Yet it was utterly useless to try to see anything. Such blackness as existed scarcely can be conceived. It was palpable and hideously brutal to the senses, as though something dead pressed up against me, something soft and icily cold. Under all this, there grew up within my mind a great and overwhelming distress of uneasiness that left me but to drop me into an uncomfortable brooding. I felt that I must fight against it, and presently, hoping to distract my thoughts, I turned to the window and looked up toward the north in search of the nebulous whiteness, which still I believed to be the far and misty glowing of the universe we had left. Even as I raised my eyes, I was thrilled with a feeling of wonder, for now the hazy light had resolved into a single great star, of vivid green. As I stared astonished, the thought flashed into my mind that the earth must be traveling toward the star, not away as I had imagined. Next, that it could not be the universe the earth had left, but possibly an outlying star belonging to some vast star cluster hidden in the enormous depths of space. With a sense of commingled awe and curiosity, I watched it, wondering what new thing was to be revealed to me. For a while, vague thoughts and speculations occupied me, during which my gaze dwelt insatiably upon that one spot of light in the otherwise pit-like darkness. Hope grew up within me, banishing the oppression of despair that had seemed to stifle me. Wherever the earth was traveling, it was at least going once more toward the realms of light. Light! One must spend an eternity wrapped in soundless night to understand the full horror of being without it. Slowly, but surely, the star grew upon my vision until in time it shone as brightly as had the planet Jupiter in the old earth days. With increased size, its color became more impressive, reminding me of a huge emerald, scintillating rays of fire across the world. Years fled away in silence, and the green star grew into a great splash of flame in the sky. A little later, I saw a thing that filled me with amazement. It was the ghostly outline of a vast crescent in the night, a gigantic new moon, seeming to be growing out of the surrounding gloom. Utterly bemused, I stared at it. It appeared to be quite close, comparatively, and I puzzled to understand how the earth had come so near to it without my having seen it before. The light thrown by the star grew stronger, and presently I was aware that it was possible to see the earthscape again, though indistinctly. A while I stared, trying to make out whether I could distinguish any detail of the world's surface, but I found the light insufficient. In a little I gave up the attempt and glanced once more toward the star. Even in the short space that my attention had been diverted, it had increased considerably, and seemed now, to my bewildered sight, about a quarter of the size of the full moon. The light it threw was extraordinarily powerful, yet its color was so abominably unfamiliar that such of the world as I could see showed unreal, more as though I looked out upon a landscape of shadow than aught else. All this time the great crescent was increasing in brightness, and began now to shine with a perceptible shade of green. Steadily the star increased in size and brilliancy until it showed fully as large as half a moon. And it grew greater and brighter, so did the vast crescent throw out more and more light, though of an ever-deepening hue of green. Under the combined blaze of their radiances, the wilderness that stretched before me became steadily more visible. Soon I seemed able to stare across the whole world, which now appeared beneath the strange light, terrible in its cold and awful flat dreariness. It was a little later that my attention was drawn to the fact that the great star of green flame was slowly sinking out of the north toward the east. At first I could scarcely believe that I saw aright, but soon there could be no doubt that it was so. Gradually it sank, and as it fell, the vast crescent of glowing green began to dwindle and dwindle, until it became a mere arc of light against the livid-colored sky. Later it vanished, disappearing in the self-same spot from which I had seen it slowly emerge. By this time, the star had come to within some 30 degrees of the hidden horizon. In size, it could now have rivaled the moon at its full, though even yet I could not distinguish its disk. This fact led me to conceive that it was still an extraordinary distance away, and this being so, I knew that its size must be huge, beyond the conception of man to understand or imagine. Suddenly, as I watched, the lower edge of the star vanished, cut by a straight, dark line. A minute, or a century, passed, and it dipped lower until the half of it had disappeared from sight. Far away out on the green plain I saw a monstrous shadow blotting it out, and advancing swiftly.
Only a third of the star was visible now. Then, like a flash, the solution of this extraordinary phenomenon revealed itself to me. The star was sinking behind the enormous mass of the dead sun. Or rather, the sun, obedient to its attraction, was rising toward it.
Author's footnote. A careful reading of the manuscript suggests that either the sun is traveling on an orbit of great eccentricity, or else that it was approaching the green star on a lessening orbit, and at this moment I conceive it to be finally torn directly from its oblique course by the gravitational pull of the immense star. End of author's footnote.
With the earth following in its trail, as these thoughts expanded in my mind, the star vanished, being completely hidden by the tremendous bulk of the sun. Over the earth there fell once more the brooding night. With the darkness came an intolerable feeling of loneliness and dread. For the first time I thought of the pit and its inmates. After that there rose in my memory the still more terrible thing that had haunted the shores of the sea of sleep and lurked in the shadows of this old building. Where were they? I wondered, and shivered with miserable thoughts. For a time fear held me, and I prayed, wildly and incoherently, for some ray of light with which to dispel the cold blackness that enveloped the world. How long I waited it is impossible to say, certainly for a very great period. Then, all at once, I saw a loom of light shine out ahead. Gradually it became more distinct. Suddenly a ray of vivid green flashed across the darkness. At the same moment I saw a thin line of livid flame far in the night. An instant it seemed, and it had grown into a great clot of fire, beneath which the world lay bathed in a blaze of emerald green light. Steadily it grew, until presently the whole of the green star had come into sight again. But now it could be scarcely called a star, for it had increased to vast proportions, being incomparably greater than the sun had been in the olden time. Then, as I stared, I became aware that I could see the edge of the lifeless sun glowing like a great crescent moon. Slowly its lighted surface broadened out to me until half of its diameter was visible, and the star began to drop away on my right. Time passed, and the earth moved on, slowly traversing the tremendous face of the dead sun.
Author's footnote. It will be noticed here that the earth was slowly traversing the tremendous face of the dead sun. No explanation is given of this, and we must conclude either that the speed of time has slowed, or else that the earth was actually progressing on its orbit at a rate slow when measured by existing standards. A careful study of the manuscript, however, leads me to conclude that the speed of time had been steadily decreasing for a very considerable period. End of author's footnote.
Gradually, as the earth traveled forward, the star fell still more to the right, until at last it shone on the back of the house, sending a flood of broken rays in through the skeleton-like walls. Glancing upward, I saw that much of the ceiling had vanished, enabling me to see that the upper stories were even more decayed. The roof had evidently gone entirely, and I could see the green effulgence of the starlight shining in slantingly.
End of chapter 18. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 19 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The End of the Solar System. From the abutment where once had been the windows, through which I had watched that first fatal dawn, I could see that the sun was hugely greater than it had been when first the star lit the world. So great was it that its lower edge seemed almost to touch the far horizon. Even as I watched, I imagined that it drew closer. The radiance of green that lit the frozen earth grew steadily brighter. Thus, for a long space, things were. Then, on a sudden, I saw that the sun was changing shape and growing smaller, just as the moon would have done in past time. In a while only a third of the illuminated part was turned toward the earth. The star bore away on the left. Gradually, as the world moved on, the star shone upon the front of the house once more, while the sun showed only as a great bow of green fire. An instant, it seemed, and the sun had vanished. The star was still fully visible. Then the earth moved into the black shadow of the sun, and all was night. Night, black, starless, and intolerable. Filled with tumultuous thoughts, I watched across the night, waiting. Years it may have been, and then in the dark house behind me, the clotted stillness of the world was broken. I seemed to hear a soft padding of many feet, and a faint, inarticulate whisper of sound grew on my senses. I looked round into the blackness and saw a multitude of eyes. As I stared, they increased and appeared to come toward me. For an instant I stood, unable to move, then a hideous swine noise.
Author's footnote. See first footnote, chapter 18. End of author's footnote.
Rose up into the night, and at that I leapt from the window out onto the frozen world. I have a confused notion of having run a while, and after that I just waited. Several times I heard shrieks, but always as though from a distance. Except for these sounds, I had no idea of the whereabouts of the house. Time moved onward. I was conscious of little save a sensation of cold and hopelessness and fear. An age, it seemed, and there came a glow that told me of the coming light. It grew tardily. Then, with a loom of unearthly glory, the first ray from the green star struck over the edge of the dark sun and lit the world. It fell upon a great ruined structure some 200 yards away. It was the house. Staring, I saw a fearsome sight. Over its walls crawled a legion of unholy things, almost covering the old building, from tottering towers to base. I could see them plainly. They were the swine creatures. The world moved out into the light of the star, and I saw that, now, it seemed to stretch across a quarter of the heavens. The glory of its livid light was so tremendous that it appeared to fill the sky with quivering flames. Then I saw the sun. It was so close that half of its diameter lay below the horizon, and as the world circled across its face, it seemed to tower right up into the sky, a stupendous dome of emerald-colored fire. From time to time I glanced toward the house, but the swine things seemed unaware of my proximity. Years appeared to pass slowly. The earth had almost reached the center of the sun's disk. The light from the green sun, as now it must be called, shone through the interstices that gapped the moldered walls of the old house, giving them the appearance of being wrapped in green flames. The swine creatures still crawled about the walls. Suddenly there rose a loud roar of swine voices, and up from the center of the roofless house shot a vast column of blood-red flame. I saw the little twisted towers and turrets flash into fire, yet still preserving their twisted crookedness. The beams of the green sun beat upon the house and intermingled with its lurid glows, so that it appeared a blazing furnace of red and green fire. Fascinated, I watched, until an overwhelming sense of coming danger drew my attention. I glanced up, and at once it was borne upon me that the sun was closer, so close, in fact, that it seemed to overhang the world. Then, I know not how, I was caught up into strange heights, floating like a bubble in the awful effulgence. Far below me I saw the earth, with the burning house leaping into an ever-growing mountain of flame. Round about it the ground appeared to be glowing, and in places heavy wreaths of yellow smoke ascended from the earth. It seemed as though the world were becoming ignited from that one plague spot of fire. Faintly I could see the swine things. They appeared quite unharmed. Then the ground seemed to cave in suddenly, and the house with its load of foul creatures disappeared into the depths of the earth, sending a strange blood-colored cloud into the heights. I remembered the hell pit under the house. In a while I looked round. The huge bulk of the sun rose high above me. The distance between it and the earth grew rapidly less. Suddenly the earth appeared to shoot forward. In a moment it had traversed the space between it and the sun. I heard no sound, but out from the sun's face gushed an ever-growing tongue of dazzling flame. It seemed to leap almost to the distant green sun, shearing through the emerald light a very cataract of blinding fire. It reached its limit and sank, and on the sun glowed a vast splash of burning white. The grave of the earth. The sun was very close to me now. Presently I found that I was rising higher until at last I rode above it, in the emptiness. The green sun was now so huge that its breath seemed to fill up all the sky ahead. I looked down and noted that the sun was passing directly beneath me. A year may have gone by, or a century, and I was left suspended alone. The sun showed far in front a black, circular mass against the molten splendor of the great green orb. Near one edge I observed that a lurid glow had appeared, marking the place where the earth had fallen. By this I knew that the long-dead sun was still revolving, though with great slowness. Afar to my right, I seemed to catch at times a faint glow of whitish light. For a great time I was uncertain whether to put this down to fancy or not. Thus for a while I stared with fresh wonderings, until at last I knew that it was no imaginary thing, but a reality. It grew brighter, and presently there slid out of the green a pale globe of softest white. It came nearer, and I saw that it was apparently surrounded by a robe of gently glowing clouds. Time passed. I glanced toward the diminishing sun. It showed only as a dark blot on the face of the green sun. As I watched, I saw it grow smaller, steadily, as though rushing toward the superior orb at an immense speed. Intently I stared. What would happen? I was conscious of extraordinary emotions as I realized that it would strike the green sun. It grew no bigger than a pea, and I looked with my whole soul to witness the final end of our system, that system which had borne the world through so many eons with its multitudinous sorrows and joys. And now, suddenly, something crossed my vision. Cutting from sight all vestige of the spectacle I watched with such soul interest, what happened to the dead sun I did not see. But I have no reason, in the light of that which I saw afterward, to disbelieve that it fell into the strange fire of the green sun, and so perished. And then suddenly an extraordinary question rose in my mind, whether this stupendous globe of green fire might not be the vast central sun, the great sun round which our universe and countless others revolve. I felt confused. I thought of the probable end of the dead sun, and another suggestion came dumbly. Do the dead stars make the green sun their grave? The idea appealed to me with no sense of grotesqueness, but rather as something both possible and probable. End of chapter 19. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 20 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Celestial Globes. For a while, many thoughts crowded my mind so that I was unable to do aught save stare blindly before me. I seemed whelmed in a sea of doubt and wonder and sorrowful remembrance. It was later that I came out of my bewilderment. I looked about dazedly. Thus I saw so extraordinary a sight that for a while I could scarcely believe I was not still wrapped in the visionary tumult of my own thoughts. Out of the reigning green had grown a boundless river of softly shimmering globes.
each one enfolded in a wondrous fleece of pure cloud. They reached both above and below me to an unknown distance, and not only hid the shining of the green sun, but supplied, in place thereof, a tender glow of light that suffused itself around me, like unto nothing I have ever seen before or since. In a little I noticed that there was about these spheres a sort of transparency, almost as though they were formed of clouded crystal, within which burned a radiance, gentle and subdued. They moved on, past me, continually, floating onward at no great speed, but rather as though they had eternity before them. A great while I watched, and could perceive no end to them. At times I seemed to distinguish faces amid the cloudiness, but strangely indistinct, as though partly real and partly formed of the mistiness through which they showed. For a long time I waited passively with a sense of growing content. I had no longer that feeling of unutterable loneliness, but felt rather that I was less alone than I had been for kalpas of years. This feeling of contentment increased so that I would have been satisfied to float in company with those celestial globules forever. Ages slipped by, and I saw the shadowy faces, with increased frequency, also with greater plainness. Whether this was due to my soul having become more attuned to its surroundings, I cannot tell. Probably it was so. But however this may be, I am assured now only of the fact that I became steadily more conscious of a new mystery about me, telling me that I had indeed penetrated within the borderland of some unthought-of region, some subtle, intangible place or form of existence. The enormous stream of luminous spheres continued to pass me at an unvarying rate, countless millions, and still they came, showing no signs of ending, nor even diminishing. Then, as I was borne silently upon the unbuoying ether, I felt a sudden irresistible forward movement toward one of the passing globes. An instant, and I was beside it. Then I slid through into the interior without experiencing the least resistance of any description. For a short while I could see nothing, and waited curiously. All at once I became aware that a sound broke the inconceivable stillness. It was like the murmur of a great sea at calm, a sea breathing in its sleep. Gradually the mist that obscured my sight began to thin away, and so, in time, my vision dwelt once again upon the silent surface of the sea of sleep. For a little I gazed and could scarcely believe I saw aright. I glanced round. There was the great globe of pale fire, swimming as I had seen it before, a short distance above the dim horizon. To my left, far across the sea, I discovered presently a faint line as of thin haze, which I guessed to be the shore where my love and I had met during those wonderful periods of soul wandering that had been granted to me in the old earth days. Another, a troubled memory came to me of the formless thing that had haunted the shores of the Sea of Sleep, the guardian of that silent, echoless place. These and other details I remembered and knew without doubt that I was looking out upon that same sea. With the assurance, I was filled with an overwhelming feeling of surprise and joy, and shaken expectancy, conceiving it possible that I was about to see my love again. Intently I gazed around, but could catch no sight of her. At that, for a little, I felt hopeless. Fervently I prayed, and ever peered anxiously. How still was the sea! Down far beneath me I could see the many trails of changeful fire that had drawn my attention formerly. Vaguely I wondered what caused them. Also I remembered that I had intended to ask my dear one about them, as well as many other matters, and I had been forced to leave her before the half that I had wished to say was said. My thoughts came back with a leap. I was conscious that something had touched me. I turned quickly. God, thou wert indeed gracious! It was she!
She looked up into my eyes with an eager longing, and I looked down to her with all my soul. I should like to have held her, but the glorious purity of her face kept me afar. Then out of the winding mist she put her dear arms. Her whisper came to me soft as the rustle of a passing cloud. "Dearest," she said. That was all but I had heard, and in a moment I held her to me as I prayed, "Forever." In a little she spoke of many things, and I listened. Willingly would I have done so through all the ages that are to come. At times I whispered back, and my whispers brought to her spirit face once more an indescribably delicate tint, the bloom of love. Later I spoke more freely, and to each word she listened and made answer delightfully, so that already I was in paradise. She and I, and nothing, save the silent spacious void to see us, and only the quiet waters of the sea of sleep to hear us. Long before, the floating multitude of cloud-enfolded spheres had vanished into nothingness. Thus we looked upon the face of the slumberous deeps, and were alone. Alone! God! I would be thus alone in the hereafter, and yet be never lonely. I had her, and greater than this, she had me. I, aeon-aged me. And on this thought and some others I hope to exist through the few remaining years that may yet lie between us. End of chapter 20. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 21 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Dark Sun. How long our souls lay in the arms of joy, I cannot say. But all at once I was waked from my happiness by a diminution of the pale and gentle light that lit the sea of sleep. I turned toward the huge white orb with a premonition of coming trouble. One side of it was curving inward as though a convex black shadow were sweeping across it. My memory went back. It was thus that the darkness had come before our last parting. I turned toward my love inquiringly. With a sudden knowledge of woe, I noticed how wan and unreal she had grown, even in that brief space. Her voice seemed to me to come from a distance. The touch of her hands was no more than the gentle pressure of a summer wind, and grew less perceptible. Already quite half of the immense globe was shrouded. A feeling of desperation seized me. Was she about to leave me? Would she have to go as she had gone before? I questioned her, anxiously, frighteningly, and she, nestling closer, explained in that strange, faraway voice that it was imperative she should leave me before the Sun of Darkness, as she termed it, blotted out the light. At this confirmation of my fears, I was overcome with despair and could only look voicelessly across the quiet plains of the silent sea. How swiftly the darkness spread across the face of the white orb! Yet in reality the time must have been long, beyond human comprehension. At last, only a crescent of pale fire lit the now dim sea of sleep. All this while she had held me, but with so soft a caress that I had been scarcely conscious of it. We waited there together, she and I, speechless for very sorrow. In the dimming light her face showed shadowy, blending into the dusky mistiness that encircled us. Then, when a thin curved line of soft light was all that lit the sea, she released me, pushing me from her tenderly. Her voice sounded in my ears, "I may not stay longer, dear one." It ended in a sob. She seemed to float away from me, and became invisible. Her voice came to me out of the shadows faintly, apparently from a great distance. "A little while." It died away remotely. In a breath the sea of sleep darkened into night. Far to my left I seemed to see for a brief instant a soft glow. It vanished,
and in the same moment I became aware that I was no longer above the still sea, but once more suspended in infinite space with the green sun, now eclipsed by a vast dark sphere before me. Utterly bewildered, I stared almost unseeingly at the ring of green flames leaping above the dark edge. Even in the chaos of my thoughts, I wondered dully at their extraordinary shapes. A multitude of questions assailed me. I thought more of her I had so lately seen than of the sight before me. My grief and thoughts of the future filled me. Was I doomed to be separated from her always? Even in the old earth days, she had been mine only for a little while. Then she had left me, as I thought, forever. Since then I had seen her but these times upon the sea of sleep. A feeling of fierce resentment filled me, and miserable questionings. Why could I not have gone with my love? What reason to keep us apart? Why had I to wait alone while she slumbered through the years on the still bosom of the sea of sleep? The sea of sleep! My thoughts turned inconsequentially out of their channel of bitterness to fresh, desperate questionings. Where was it? Where was it? I seemed to have but just parted from my love upon its quiet surface, and it had gone, utterly. It could not be far away, and the white orb which I had seen hidden in the shadow of the sun-darkness. My sight dwelt upon the green sun, eclipsed. What had it eclipsed? Was there a vast dead star circling it? Was the central sun, as I had come to regard it, a double star? The thought had come almost unbidden, yet why should it not be so? My thoughts went back to the white orb. Strange that it should have been. I stopped. An idea had come suddenly. The white orb and the green sun. Were they one and the same? My imagination wandered backward, and I remembered the luminous globe to which I had been so unaccountably attracted. It was curious that I should have forgotten it even momentarily. Where were the others? I reverted again to the globe I had entered. I thought for a time, and matters became clearer. I conceived that by entering that impalpable globule, I had passed at once into some further and until then invisible dimension. There the great sun was still visible, but as a stupendous sphere of pale white light, almost as though its ghost showed and not its material part. A long time I mused on the subject. I remembered how, on entering the sphere, I had immediately lost all sight of the others. For a still further period I continued to revolve the different details in my mind. In a while my thoughts turned to other things. I came more into the present and began to look about me seeingly. For the first time I perceived that innumerable rays of a subtle violet hue pierced the strange semi-darkness in all directions. They radiated from the fiery rim of the green sun. They seemed to grow upon my vision, so that in a little while I saw that they were countless. The night was filled with them, spreading outward from the green sun fan-wise. I concluded that I was enabled to see them by reason of the sun's glory being cut off by the eclipse. They reached right out into space and vanished. Gradually, as I looked, I became aware that fine points of intensely brilliant light traversed the rays. Many of them seemed to travel from the green sun into the distance. Others came out of the void toward the sun. But one and all, each kept strictly to the ray in which it traveled. Their speed was inconceivably great, and it was only when they neared the green sun, or as they left it, that I could see them as separate specks of light. Further from the sun they became thin lines of vivid fire within the violet. The discovery of these rays and the moving sparks interested me extraordinarily. To where did they lead in such countless profusion? I thought of the worlds in space. And those sparks! Messengers! Possibly the idea was fantastic, but
I was not conscious of its being so. Messengers! Messengers from the central sun! An idea evolved itself slowly. Was the green sun the abode of some vast intelligence? The thought was bewildering. Visions of the unnameable rose vaguely. Had I indeed come upon the dwelling place of the eternal? For a time I repelled the thought dumbly. It was too stupendous. Yet huge, vague thoughts had birth within me. I felt suddenly terribly naked, and an awful nearness shook me. And heaven, was that an illusion? My thoughts came and went erratically. The sea of sleep and she, heaven. I came back with a bound to the present. Somewhere out of the void beneath me there rushed an immense, dark body, huge and silent. It was a dead star, hurling onward to the burying place of the stars. It drove between me and the central suns, blotting them out from my vision and plunging me into an impenetrable night. An age, and I saw again the violet rays. A great while later, eons it must have been, a circular glow grew in the sky ahead, and I saw the edge of the receding star showing darkly against it. Thus I knew that it was nearing the central suns. Presently I saw the bright ring of the green sun shone plainly against the night. The star had passed into the shadow of the dead sun. After that I just waited. The strange years went slowly, and ever I watched intently. The thing I had expected came at last, suddenly, awfully. A vast flare of dazzling light, a streaming burst of white flame across the dark void. For an indefinite while it soared outward, a gigantic mushroom of fire. It ceased to grow, then, as time went by, it began to sink backward, slowly. I saw now that it came from a huge, glowing spot near the center of the dark sun. Mighty flames still soared outward from this. Yet, spite of its size, the grave of the star was no more than the shining of Jupiter upon the face of an ocean, when compared with the inconceivable mass of the dead sun. I may remark here once more that no words will ever convey to the imagination the enormous bulk of the two central suns.
End of chapter 21. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.